Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. There are still 3 days left to play along, y'all. What is Janet Yellen thinking in five words or less? Ready, go! From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 14th of September. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And yes, I know I said it's Monday, but the heck with that. We're going to go straight to Thursday's news to start things off today. The Fed interest rates, will they or won't they? I have no idea, honestly. You can find respected analysts and economists on both sides of the issue. But riddle me this just for a second. Let's say, for the sake of argument, they do decide on a rate hike. Then what happens? Because it's been a while, you know. From New York, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets down into the weeds.
If, and I get that this might be a big if, but if you have ever thought about how the Federal Reserve sets interest rates, you might have thought it went a little something like this. The Fed raises its federal funds rate, which is the rate banks charge to loan money to each other, and that causes other rates to climb.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a terrible shorthand for the way that things used to work.
Binyamin Applebaum is a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He had a huge story in the paper this weekend about how things actually work now. He says the Fed pumped so much money into the economy as a response to the financial crisis that its old way of raising rates won't work anymore. So the Fed has a new plan.
It has two basic parts, one of which is a system for paying banks not to be as aggressive in their lending, and the other is a system for paying non-banks, other kinds of financial firms, to also be more cautious.
And the Fed hopes that achieves the same rate-increasing outcome. Applebaum says in theory and in small test runs, the idea seems sound. Part of the significance of the change is just that it's a change.
And it's a big one. In terms of the underlying mechanics of reserves and currency and all that, that hasn't changed since the 60s, I think.
Joe Gagneau is with the Peterson Institute and used to work at the Fed. If everything goes according to plan, Kevin Jakes, a professor at Baldwin Wallace University, says you and I, we won't even notice the new approach. But
we could see some unintended consequences. And if we do, what will they look like? Where will they appear? And how will they influence financial markets?
Jake says we won't really know until the Fed decides to change rates, whenever that may be. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Thursday, not Thursday, I don't know, but you ought to read Binya Applebaum's piece. It's a real good one in the New York Times this weekend. All right, the real news story of the day, or at least it's more today than a Fed announcement 72 hours from now, are the fires that have basically exploded in parts of Northern California. It wasn't a literal explosion, of course, but the Valley Fire that started Saturday has already burned 61,000 acres and counting. It's burned at least 400 structures, many of them in Middletown, California, where Ross Hardister's family has owned and operated Hardister's Market and Hardware since 1943. Hi, Ross.
Hey.
Tell me what it's been like.
I mean, it's sad. There's devastation in the neighborhoods surrounding the communities. We get people straggling in. Some of them save their houses. And most of the people here in town, their houses are still standing. So they're getting a few groceries to keep themselves fed.
Who's coming in and what are they buying?
Just the locals. They're just buying milk, bread, whatever they can get. People are coming in for some hardware items. They're trying to get their generators going. Not a ton of traffic, but people are trying to survive.
You have a bunch of people working there with you, or is it just you and your brother, or who's manning the store?
Yeah, my brother and a couple other managers. We're here talking with people and trying to keep one register open so they can get stuff.
Did you send all your staff home so that they could get their stuff and take care of their stuff?
Yeah, the fire happened so quickly on Saturday, about 5 o'clock. Both of our stores closed, and they could see flames, you know, coming in the hills down into town. So they all took off, and I went home to get their stuff and get out of the way.
When are you going to know if everything's going to be all right, Ross?
We have hope. The fire department doesn't know too much. They're just trying to get control of the different angles of the fire. So we're hoping the next day or two they can start getting some control and then can let everybody know. A lot of people call into the store and want to know when the roads are open, want to know if what we hear about their neighborhoods. We don't have much information, but we can look across the street or go on what we've... We try not to spread rumors, but if we know a fact, then we can tell them.
Do you have the fire crews swinging by? I mean, are they looking for, you know, a cold drink and all that?
Yeah, the firefighters are, I think they're taken well care of from their suppliers. But, yeah, they like to come in, the air conditioning, and they'll get drinks and chips and take a little deep breath, then they're on their way.
What are you going to do after this? I mean, is there a thing about rebuilding this town and trying to save things?
Definitely. Things like this have happened before. It'll take time, but people will rebuild and get back in their homes and their properties and fight, you know, to get their lives back.
Ross Hardister, he and his brother run Hardister's Market and Hardware up in Middletown, California. Ross, thanks very much for your time. Good luck.
All right. Thanks.
On Wall Street today, which sort of pales when you think about it, traders are just waiting and watching this week. There is, as you know, a Fed meeting. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The migrant and refugee crisis going on over in Europe right now is first and foremost a humanitarian tragedy. But with the news out of Germany this weekend that it's going to tighten its border controls, steps that other European countries announced today as well, by the way, this story is rapidly becoming an economic one. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains.
In most of the 28 countries of the European Union, you can cross borders without showing your passport in what's called the Schengen area. But now, some countries, including Germany and Hungary, are changing that.
A couple of member states have felt the need to reintroduce border checks just to make sure that they have the situation fully under control on a temporary basis.
David O'Sullivan is the European Union's ambassador to the U.S. He says the border checks are allowed, especially given the scale of the crisis. But in some ways, free movement for goods and labor is already being limited. Wolfgang Donsbeck-Gruber is a professor at Princeton University and just returned from Europe. He says the masses of people gathered at some train stations are causing problems for Europeans traveling for work.
Because of all kinds of problems or controls, trains would be delayed and you would have, for European rail connections, unheard of delays.
The cost of the delays for businesses isn't yet clear, but Arup Zucci of consulting firm Frost & Sullivan says he expects it to be about $350 million a day. That's what he's seeing in the UK. Like Ireland, it isn't part of the Schengen Agreement.
So when you have a disruption of this nature, it has a ripple effect across the entire value chain.
But ultimately, he says Europe's economy will benefit from the influx of refugees and migrants. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
After putting those new border controls in place this morning, the German government started letting trains from Austria enter the country again. The BBC's Ben James joined Syrian refugees on a train from Hungary to Germany on board one of those trains.
What are your names? Where are you from?
My name is Saad. I'm from Syria.
Where in Syria?
Homs.
And what about you?
Yeah, I'm her cousin. My name is Ammar.
How did you come to be on this train?
We walk for 8 hours from Serbia to Hungary to cross the border. It was really dangerous, but we walked and then we get a taxi to Budapest.
And where do you want to go in the end?
Germany.
You're both smiling at me as if, you know, you've... don't really mind anymore. I mean, has this been a hard journey? Because you seem in pretty good spirits. You both seem pretty happy.
No.
Is that because of what you've left behind back at home?
No, because we believe in God and we are going to a better life, maybe to some place like we feel safe.
What's it like in Homs at the moment?
War. Yeah, it's not safe at all. I can't go to college. I'm studying electrical and telecommunication engineering, but I couldn't finish my college, so I'm trying to finish my college there. I'm looking for a new life, for a new job, for a new home.
So it doesn't matter where it is, as long as it's safe and as long as your family is there?
I don't mind, here or Germany or in any place. I want to be safe. I want to be happy. I want to work, to have a future, to have a dream. And we are still young, so in Syria it kills our dream. So we can't dream.
That was the BBC's Ben James with Syrian refugees on a train from Hungary over to Germany. Coming up.
Arguably, the problem is worse now than it's ever been before. I think it's a total scandal.
It ain't easy being a mortgage giant, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 62 points today, about 0.4%, closed at 16,370. The NASDAQ off 16 points, 0.3%, 4805. The S&P 500 down 8 points, 0.4%, ended things at 1,953. Probably going to be that way all week, waiting for the Fed. Falling oil prices hit energy stocks today. Valero slipped 3.4%. Cabot Oil and Gas gave up 3.8%. Raw materials were under pressure too. Aluminum giant Alcoa dulled itself 2.8% lower. Agrochemical provider Monsanto yielded about 2.5%. Drug firms dipped as well. Raptor Pharmaceuticals off 37%. Company said it might scrap a liver disease treatment it's been developing after the drug failed a key test. Bond prices rose just a hair. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note stopped pretty much where it ended Friday. That would be 2.18%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. For those of you who keep track of these kinds of things, and I know there are many of you, there's going to be one fewer Republican on stage for the CNN GOP debate day after tomorrow. Actually, it's going to be two fewer. Former Virginia Governor Jim Gilmore hasn't done well enough in the polls to even make the JV debate before the main event. And as you might have heard, former Texas Governor Rick Perry called it quits on Friday. Technically, he suspended his campaign. A campaign that, oh, by the by, ran out of money a couple of weeks ago, even though his political action committees still do have millions. And that, in turn, raises this suddenly pertinent question. What are all those super PACs going to do with all that money now that their guy is out? Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that story.
Right now, the group of PACs known as Opportunity and Freedom, which was supporting Rick Perry, has no answer to that question.
Well, this was a complete surprise.
That's Stefan Pasentino. He's the lawyer for the super PACs. Candidates can't directly communicate with their PACs, so Pasentino says they haven't had time to change direction.
We had just, in the days before the announcement, made a significant ad purchase.
With the reported $13 million the group has in the bank. It also now has lots of options of how to spend that money, says Jan Barron. He heads the election law practice at the firm Wiley Rhine.
I'm guessing that the Perry super PACs are hearing from many other super PACs who would like their money.
And from the PAC's donors who might get a refund. Barron says the super PACs could also directly support another candidate or give money to charity. He says the group could even convert its millions for the personal use of the people running the PACs.
It's legally possible, but is highly discouraged.
That's polite lawyer talk for bad idea. Stefan Pasentino says there is another possible outcome.
Theoretically, if there was a candidate out there that Governor Perry's supporters did not particularly think should be the Republican nominee, this group could certainly pay for independent ads opposing that candidate.
Gee, can you think of anyone who fits that description? Maybe a front runner?
He put glasses on so people will think he's smart. And it just doesn't work. You know, people can see through the glasses.
I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
When the very idea of you having a job or not having a job depends on the price of a notoriously volatile commodity, that does not for a stable domestic financial picture make. A barrel of crude oil costs less than half what it did a year ago. Drilling rigs are shutting down right and left, and oil workers can go from making six figures a year to nothing virtually overnight. Lee Patterson reports on the challenges of budgeting in a boom and bust economy.
With oil prices in the tank, business in the oil fields is tough.
Yeah, we laid off all except for Jordy for about a month and a half.
That's Justin Gamble. I met him at a bar in Gillette, a town in northeastern Wyoming.
And I'm a salesman for New Coda. It's an oil field service and rental company.
Now Jordy, the one who didn't get laid off.
Of course, I'm indispensable.
His name is Jordan Couch. He is a 22-year-old cowboy and now a supervisor at New Coda. The company actually didn't have work for him for a while, but it was easy to keep him around because he had his own housing. But he wasn't getting paid.
I had like maybe $3,000 saved up.
That was gone in just a few weeks.
Truck payment, $1,000 a month. Rent, $1,000 a month.
By the time work picked up, Couch says he was already behind on truck payments and was almost evicted from his apartment. And that is where Couch's boss, Justin Gamble, steps in as a sort of financial advisor.
They blow every penny they get. They make more money than they've ever made before, and they think it's going to be steady. I tell them all the time, they need to save their money.
Gamble has been through downturns in the energy and steelmaking industries, as well as a divorce and now child support. He knows the money doesn't always last.
Yeah, they learn the hard way. Nothing's secure, unless you're making toilet paper, I guess.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. has lost around 5,000 oil and gas jobs over the past year. But the debt that often follows, it hasn't shown up in banks' balance sheets quite yet.
The typical ones on here are certainly your unsecured credit cards, your signature loans, your new vehicles.
Kurt Phelan, CEO of Campco Federal Credit Union in Gillette, walks me through his most recent loan loss sheet. His records don't show any big losses yet.
It's been more of just the last 60 days that we've really started to see a real change.
A change in the number of people coming in because they can't make their payments, and in the number of vehicles being turned over to Campco. That's more than doubled.
We know we've only hit the tip of the iceberg, so it's going to be a matter of how low will these prices go and how long will they go.
In the past, low oil prices for long periods of time have hit oil towns hard. Mark Zaback knows that firsthand. He's a banker who moved to Wyoming in 1982, just a few years before the oil bust.
You had people leaving town, and it happened almost overnight. Just almost overnight.
In 1985, personal and business bankruptcy filings in the state were nearly triple what they were in 1980, and several local banks shut their doors.
I remember having customers who were robbing their kids' savings accounts to make payroll taxes for their company back then.
The layoffs, the debt, the battered local economies, Zaback, like many others, is seeing warning signs that it could happen all over again. And for workers, a lot of it comes down to this.
The lack of financial literacy. We see it every day. You have young people coming out of high school or maybe college, all of a sudden they're getting a six-figure check.
Most young workers don't come to the oil patch with strong money management skills. And the banks, well, encouraging lending is part of the business plan. Back at the bar, we go outside. That truck, Jordan Couch still has it. And he's keeping it.
Oh, 100%. Even if I go back to cowboying, I'm still making $1,000 a month. I can make the payment.
Yeah.
Who eats, right?
Ah, the wisdom of youth. Sometimes the love of a truck trumps any attempt at money management. In Gillette, Wyoming, I'm Lee Patterson for Marketplace.
Lee's story was produced for us by Inside Energy. That's a public media collaboration focused on this country's energy issues. We've been talking about mortgages and the mortgage crisis and the challenges of the American real estate industry on this program for about 8 years now, almost, honestly, as long as we've been talking about when the Fed might raise interest rates. But you can't cover mortgages in this country, though, and how we get them without talking about the two elephants in the room, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which together are behind an overwhelming percentage of all the home loans that we get and which, since the dark early days of the financial crisis, we, the American taxpayer, have owned. Fannie and Freddie are the subject of a new book by Bethany McLean. It's called Shaky Ground, The Strange Saga of the U.S. Mortgage Giants. Bethany, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if maybe the place to start is for you to give like a 30-second primer on what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac actually are.
So they are part of the mysterious machinery that is an important component of most Americans' lives, but you actually never think about it until things go wrong. What they do is they buy mortgages from the institutions like banks who make them, and then they package them up into securities and sell them on to investors. And without the presence of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to buy up those mortgages, it's not clear whether the original lenders would make the mortgages in the first place.
All right, here's the thing. I still don't understand about these guys, and obviously I've been doing this for longer than I'd care to remember. Almost everybody out there at some point in the last 10-ish years has said, let's get rid of them. We had this financial crisis, we had the opportunity, and yet we didn't. What's going on?
Oh, that's a great question. So, yes, that was the wisdom, most definitely, after the financial crisis. I even wrote it in my last book that the silver lining in all of this was that we had a chance to rethink mm-hmm. housing policy. And we didn't. 7 years later, these two companies are still sitting in conservatorship. Arguably, the dependence on them is greater mm-hmm. than it has ever been before, because it turned out that private capital doesn't like asset classes like mortgages that have caused it problems. And mm-hmm. in the wake of the financial crisis, no bank wanted to make a mortgage unless they could sell it to Fannie and Freddie. So we've been totally reliant on these two companies, but people seem utterly unable to change.
We spent, taxpayers did, plus or minus $200 billion getting these things bailed out and into conservatorship and back into some kind of running form. They are now profitable to the tune of billions and billions of dollars. Where is that money going?
Well, that is part of the problem. The U.S. government changed the rules in the summer of 2012. They said, well, private shareholders, it doesn't matter. We're going to take every single dollar of profit these companies make into eternity, basically. And so they've been taking that money, and it's been used to make our budget deficit look better than it otherwise would. And that's really problematic, because using these two companies' profits as a slush fund has left them with no capital to fall back on in the wake of another downturn in the housing market, which means they would go right back on taxpayers' dole. So not only have we failed to sort of fix the underlying issues in the housing market and think about a better solution for the housing market, but arguably the problem is worse now than it's ever been before. I think it's a total scandal.
Am I oversimplifying it too much if I say that there are basically two solutions to what to do about Fannie and Freddie and the state of the American housing market? We could push a button, get rid of them, and depend on private capital to engage in the mortgage market. And we know what happens, as you said, when it sees things it doesn't like, private capital goes away. The other side of that coin is to, what, reconstitute Fannie and Freddie as they were with the government heavily involved? Is there no middle ground, I guess, is the question.
My view, and I was shocked to find myself coming to this, it's sort of a take on Winston Churchill's famous line about democracy. It's the worst of all of all systems, with the possible exception of all others. And I've come to believe that about Fannie and Freddie, that the best thing, at the risk of mixing all my analogies, it's kind of the devil you know. Let's take it. Let's fix it. We know what some of the problems with the old structure were. Let's make them better. No, it's not perfect, but the alternatives aren't perfect either. And I'll just make one more comment about that. This thing about private capital is really kind of an illusion. Private capital would be America's biggest banks. They too were bailed out in the financial crisis. If they were supporting the mortgage market, they too would be bailed out again. They too are government-sponsored enterprises.
The latest book from Bethany McLean, it is a slim volume. It is called Shaky Ground, The Strange Saga of the U.S. Mortgage Giants. It's actually a fascinating read when you realize what's happened to these two companies. Bethany, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, if this whole being president thing doesn't work out for Donald Trump, it looks like he is not going to be able to get his old job back. NBC announced Trump's replacement on Celebrity Apprentice this afternoon. Here's a hint for you. Instead of "you're fired," it's probably going to be something like "hasta la vista, baby." Yes, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I don't know really that there's a lot to add after that. All right, we got to go. Watching and waiting was the byword on Wall Street today. The Dow off 62 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ off 16 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 dropped 8 points, 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and here's what Arnold would say now that I think about it. You ready? Here we go. I'll be back. Come on, right? Seriously? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.